This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J. M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, the climate is getting warmer and humans are to blame. Undersecretary of State Timothy Wirth and Massachusetts Senator John Kerry discussed the proposed climate change treaty. We talk green about solar energy. Today, we generate most of our electricity from fuel which causes the climate to warm. Is solar a solution? And in the Earth calendar, grunions follow the moon to mate on the shores of Southern California. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. Global warming has been called one of the most important environmental issues of our time. At the end of this year, the world's industrialized nations will meet in Kyoto, Japan, with hopes of signing a treaty to limit some of the gases believed to cause global warming. But the road to the treaty may not be smooth. There are many ways to approach the subject, and some corporations have mounted strong opposition to the treaty, saying it will hurt the economy. Others claim it needs to be stronger. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally has this report.
According to an overwhelming number of the world's scientists, human activity is changing the climate. Some industries say there are doubts about this, but most scientists disagree. Henry Kendall is the chairman of the Union of Concerned Scientists and a professor of physics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
I think the consensus in the scientific community now is clearly that there is a human influence on the environment. We also ought to take some insurance steps also in case the worst of the projections comes to pass. But even if that isn't so, there are many things we should be doing now. It's quite an urgent problem.
Why should we care about a rise of only a few degrees in the global temperature? Kendall says global warming may lead to a rise in sea levels, stronger and more frequent weather events like hurricanes and droughts, and a spreading of tropical diseases. Since the entire globe is affected by climate change, cutting back on carbon dioxide and other gases will take action from all the world's nations. And this September in Kyoto, the world's industrial nations are expected to sign a climate change agreement. Timothy Wirth is a U.S. Undersecretary of State and the lead U.S. diplomat on climate change. He says the U.S. is supporting a complex set of strategies to combat climate change without upsetting the economy.
Well, the United States believes we should have, as Senator Chafee said, a kind of flexible but binding target. By that, we mean not one that's focused on a particular year, but that averages years. For example, you have a lot of differences between in a five-year period or a 10-year period, and we think you ought to have averages. We think that countries ought to, as they change their technologies, be able to borrow against the future, you know, with limitations, but to say we're going to make this major change, like the British changed dramatically from a coal-based economy to a natural gas-based economy. And countries that are making that kind of significant change ought to be able to anticipate that and be rewarded for doing so. We ought to have a flexible program that allows emissions trading between countries and that ought to allow joint implementation, which is projects that would be implemented jointly by a company in the United States and a company in Brazil, for example.
The challenge now is getting support for the treaty. Senator John Kerry is a Democrat from Massachusetts. He says the treaty will have to satisfy several conditions if it's to have congressional backing.
Well, I'm hopeful, but it will depend on a number of factors. Number one, it'll depend on the comprehensiveness of the treaty. The treaty needs to bring in all countries and reach some means of getting the non-developed countries to join into the process sufficiently that the developed countries don't feel like they're the only ones biting the bullet. Secondly, it will have to have fixed goals that can be measured. And thirdly, the science is going to have to be very clearly defined in a way that convinces some of your reluctant participants that there really are downsides that merit taking investments and taking the time to change over our standards.
Thus far, only developed nations like the U.S., Japan, Europe, and Australia are expected to sign the Kyoto Treaty, even though developing nations like China and India emit just as much greenhouse gases as developed nations. But these gases last hundreds and even thousands of years, and most of it has been put there by industrial nations. Senator Kerry says the U.S. and its allies will act first, but action from other countries must follow.
Kyoto, I think you got to bring in everybody. I think you all got to sign it. I think that I don't think you're going to get the U.S. Senate particularly excited about having India and China left out, since they're the number 2 and 6 greenhouse gas emitters, respectively.
The treaty will require a major shift in our economy, away from coal and oil, and towards cleaner energy technologies like natural gas and solar energy. But Wirth says the treaty will lead to more, not less, economic opportunity.
There was recently a major letter that came out from hundreds and hundreds of members of the American Economic Association. These are economists of all stripes, liberal, conservative, everybody you can think of, who said that the impact of a climate negotiation and a stabilization of greenhouse gas emissions will hardly be felt in our economy. And in fact, many feel that an aggressive and good program on greenhouse gases would be beneficial for our economy. And of course, what we do is going to be beneficial overall for the environment, and long term, that's going to be beneficial for the economy. Those who assume that there is no relationship between the economy and the environment are living in a 30 or 40 years ago economic view of the world. I think now, again, most people looking at the future of the world understand that the environment and the economy are closely intertwined, whether we're thinking about support systems, water, clean air, oceans, whatever it may be. You know, that we have got to care for our environment if, in fact, we're going to be able to sustain our economy.
For the next 8 months, negotiations will take place around the world, culminating in Kyoto in December, where a treaty is expected to be signed. Scientists say action now is critical. They've been able to look back 20,000 years at the climate through air trapped in ice cores, and found that during the Ice Age, there were about 200 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. During warm periods, there were 280 parts per million. Today, there are 360 parts per million, and if we continue on our current track, they expect we'll hit 700 parts per million within a century. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
As concern over climate change grows, nations are focusing on energy, the industry overwhelmingly responsible for greenhouse gases. Scientists say that technology is here to produce our energy much cleaner than we do today. But it's still expensive and so new that we don't know how to use it to its full extent. Of all the clean energy technologies, solar energy may be the most promising. Its fuel is sunshine, and it produces no pollution. John Thornton is with the U.S. Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory. He says solar energy, which uses photovoltaic solar panels, is slowly and quietly becoming more common. But most Americans are unaware of that, since 75% of U.S. photovoltaics are sent to overseas markets.
Sales of photovoltaics have been growing at about 15% per year, so the manufacturers are having trouble actually keeping up with the demand. And there are about 2 billion people in the world that have no electricity at all. And their only possible source of electricity is photovoltaics, and in those markets we compete very well.
So solar energy is growing, but many question whether it can fulfill our energy needs and whether it will do so in time before climate change really takes its toll. Stay tuned. We'll be talking green about solar energy next. We're talking green on the Environment Show, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today, we're talking about photovoltaics, or using the sun to make electricity. We want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Our guests today are two experts. One is John Thornton. He's leader of the Photovoltaic Markets and Applications Team of the Department of Energy's National Renewable Energies Laboratory. And John Osborne, he is project manager for the Sacramento Municipal Utilities District, otherwise known as SMUD. Again, we're talking about making electricity from sunlight. And John Thornton, let's start with you. In a nutshell, what is the process, or simply, how do you make electricity from sunlight?
Well, with photovoltaics, sunlight strikes the surface of a semiconductor device. It's completely passive. The semiconductor device just is stimulated and generates an electric current, which then is used in a normal manner. It generates a direct current, which you can use directly, or you can invert it and use it AC power, much like comes off your outlet from
and
your local
so
utility.
These are the panels that we've seen sometimes on roofs or sometimes on somebody's handheld calculator. That's the device itself.
That's correct. You see it very commonly in road signs, call boxes, on calculators, stop signs, traffic lights, and so forth.
Well, that seems understandable. Traffic lights, handheld computers, and so on. Don Osborne, how does the city of Sacramento make use of this to meet what I assume is a much broader demand?
Well, Peter, we've installed over 5 megawatts of photovoltaics here in Sacramento.
And again, for the layman, how many houses does a megawatt light?
Well, 5 megawatts would provide enough energy for something on the order of 1,000, 1,500 homes.
Wow. So you can light 5,000 homes with what you've got in place.
Right.
And how have you done that?
What we've done is how can we accelerate the commercialization of photovoltaics for grid-connected applications so that their price will come down faster and become cost-effective sooner for our needs.
So have you...
I need to point out that for many applications today, PV is already the cost-effective choice.
And again, PV meaning
photovoltaics.
Now, have you done this by hanging grids or these panels up around the town? How does Sacramento make it work?
Well, we have them in a number of locations. First off, we have over 400 customers, residential and commercial, who have permitted us to put PV systems to support the grid on their roofs. And so we have a couple of megawatts, which is actually rooftop photovoltaics, taking use of those roofs, which are sitting there soaking in the sun and collecting the energy that would otherwise be wasted. We also have PV at some of our substation facilities, and we have a large photovoltaic system just being completed over one part of the parking lot at the Sacramento International Airport.
So in this case, you're putting it right into the grid system that supplies electricity to everybody. It's not simply supplying the building that it happens to be sitting on.
Right. Under our current program, those systems are all feeding into the grid for the benefit of all the customers in Sacramento, and SMUD is paying for installing and operating these systems.
And can you make any money doing this? Is this cost effective?
Right now, PV is about twice or two to three times more expensive than it needs to be cost competitive in these applications. But by doing this large-scale program on a year-by-year basis and continuing it, we have seen prices drop tremendously and, in fact, are just completing a multi-year 10-megawatt procurement, which will result in PV both being manufactured in Sacramento for the economic development and cost by the year 2002, which begin to be self-sustaining, self-supporting in the retail market.
So, okay, well, let's go to the phones. We have a call from Jim in Washington. Our number is 1-888-4-9-GREEN. Jim, welcome to the Environment Show. We're talking about photovoltaics.
Hi, yeah, thanks. It all sounds very promising. I guess the question that I would have is how practical can it be, and does it really have the legs to go beyond the promising dimensions that have been described? In other words, can this really do the job over the long term? That's the question I have.
Okay, well, let's ask both our guests on that. John, let's start with you. Over the long term, where are we going?
I think over the long term, there's an enormous potential for photovoltaics. As much as we manufacture in the United States and the rest of the world demand for it is increasing at a more rapid rate. And that means that we virtually sell everything we make for right now, almost for cost-effective purposes. As the price continues to drop, however, we can expect to see larger and larger penetrations of markets in the United States. And I think that in the early part of the 21st century, you're going to see a huge contribution in the residential and commercial sectors throughout our country, much more than people currently think about. As far as being practical, it's very, very practical. The lifetime of these units is now on the order of 20 to 30 years. You can actually get warranties with a system that will guarantee parts of it for 10 to 20 years with batteries in the power conditioning system somewhat less, but they're extremely reliable. And in fact, that's one of our biggest assets, is that we operate in crises where the normal utility grids and all else fails. The photovoltaic systems keep on working.
Thanks for your call, Jim. Let me ask you both a question. I think a lot of folk, particularly in the U.S., I think it would be great if they could have some gadget on their roof that generated electricity, and then when they weren't using it or weren't home, it was running their meter backward, and they weren't worrying about batteries and storage and all that sort of thing. Will we get to the stage when that's an alternative that homeowners will find attractive and useful?
Well, we're already there. In California, as well as a dozen or so other states, there are what's called net metering laws or regulations. That's where the utility, when someone puts in a photovoltaic system, the utility must provide for that system to, when it's generating excess power beyond what the homeowner requires, to allow the power to flow back into the grid and literally turn the meter backwards.
And is that working? Can you do that and don't need the batteries and all that stuff that goes with a normal application when you're not hooked up to the grid?
For grid-connected applications, yes, indeed, that's happening and that does work.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and I'm talking to Tom from Massachusetts.
Thank you, Peter, for the intro. Greetings to Don and John as well. I'm with the Northeast Sustainable Energy Association, so we are familiar with this technology. And my question is basically one of timing. Many times I'm asked by people, if this technology for making electricity from the sun is here, why is it taking it so long to get it into the marketplace? I have a hard time responding to that question, and I wondered what your guest's thoughts might be, and in particular how SMUD's recently announced 10-megawatt PV project will advance the utilization of PV in all renewables.
Okay. Don, how do you respond?
Well, hello, Tom. And first of all, I'd like to say there's plenty of opportunity for use of photovoltaics in the Northeast. The popular conception is that there's no sun, but and they're not usable, but I have personal experience that says it's very, very applicable.
Tom, did you ever see the sun this winter?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. I think it was a long winter in the Northeast.
As a matter of fact, after this recent storm that we just had in Boston last weekend, the day after was one of the nicest days you could have imagined, and a lot of people were without power at that time.
John, let me ask you something. Do you see technology on the way in your role at the National Renewable Energies Lab that will make this even more efficient in the future, or have we hit the technology peak, and now it's a question of application and marketing?
No, I think that research has a long way to go. The conventional currently available photovoltaics works quite well, and we're even making substantial improvements in that. But over and beyond that, there's experimentation with new materials and new types of devices. For example, the one that is somewhat here today but is definitely will be a big part of the future is thin film photovoltaics. The thin films are very amenable to mass production. They use about 1/300th of the material of a crystalline solar cell. They use about 1/2 to 1/3 of the energy to manufacture. And you can imagine the effect on manufacturing cost, and then therefore the price can come down.
So this is what's inside the paddle, the thing that actually soaks up the sunlight, is that it?
That's right. The semiconductor layer is millionths of an inch thick instead of thousandths of an inch thick, and it may not sound like a whole lot, but it makes an enormous difference as far as the manufacturability and the less material used. There are products in development right now, shingles for your house, where you lay down whole strips, 8-foot long strips of shingles, and you shingle your roof just like you would with an asphalt shingle. There's other kinds that lay flat on the roof. Very many exciting projects just or products coming out of the lines right now, and they should be commercially available by the year 2000 in some quantity. So I think you can look forward to some very dramatic improvements in the technology.
Okay. Well, I'm afraid our time is up. We've been talking green on the Environment Show about making electricity out of sunlight. And my guests have been John Thornton from the Department of Energy's National Renewable Energies Laboratory and Don Osborne from the Sacramento Municipal Utilities District, known as SMUD. Gentlemen, thank you both. We really appreciate your joining us on the Environment Show.
Well, we want to
hear from all of you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. April marks the peak of the Grunion Run on the beaches of Southern California. The grunion is a nondescript silvery fish, 7 or 8 inches long, that is found only on the coast of Southern California and Baja California. The interesting thing about them is that on the nights after the highest tide, they come out of the water to spawn, and on some beaches they number in the thousands. In fact, people say sometimes they're so thick you can smell them. We spoke with Jean-Francois Bertrand. He's an educator at the Birch Aquarium of the Scripps Oceanographic Institute at La Jolla, California.
Well, this is the spawning season for grunion, and what these fish are doing is at night, after the high tide, while it's still dark outside, the grunion are rushing up on the beach with the waves that are rushing up on sandy beaches, and the females are digging down into the sand above the waterline, and the males are joining them, and they are laying their eggs in the sand above the waterline on beaches around here.
And then do the males fertilize the eggs after they've been laid?
Yes. What the female does is she will sort of corkscrew her way down into the sand, and the males, normally it's a few males to per female, will sort of wrap themselves around her body. And as she slowly turns, depositing her eggs, the males will release their milt, which will run down the sides of her body and fertilize the eggs under the sand.
And how deep in the sand are the eggs planted or laid?
Well, the fish themselves are only about 6 to 7 inches long, so the female only deposits them maybe 5 inches below the sand. But one of the characteristics of tides, of the rising and lowering tides, is that as the tide goes down, it deposits sand on the beach. So these grunion will lay their eggs after the peak of the tide, after the peak of the high tide, as the tide is beginning to go down. And as the tide goes down, it will deposit more and more sand on top of these eggs. So the eggs end up being buried about 8 to 10 inches below the sand.
And the eggs are being laid now. How long does it take for them to hatch?
Well, the eggs will take about 15 days to hatch, and that is actually the time until the next high tide. And just as the tide goes down, it deposits sand on the beach. As the tide rises, it scoops sand off. So 2 weeks after the high tide where the eggs were laid, the tide will again be approaching its peak height. And as this tide rises, it will wash away the sand that covered up these eggs, and with the agitation of the waves, these eggs will hatch and the baby grunion will swim out into the water column.
J.F. Bertrand is an educator at the Scripps Oceanographic Institute at the Birch Aquarium in La Jolla, California. The grunions tell us that for them at least, being a fish out of water is an essential part of the life cycle. So if you feel like a fish out of water sometimes, maybe it's not so bad, provided it's on a night after the high tide and nobody is running around trying to catch you in their bare hands. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, stuff. We use a lot of it. Can we make stuff using less stuff? Parks are being created in Italy as fast as the Lamborghini speeds around the track. Our ear to the ground, Linda Anderson, rescues turtles in Southern California. Orangutans help build a solar energy system in Kalimantan-Tanga. And singer-songwriter Victoria Parks declares she's going solar. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. In every serious discussion of the environment, people conclude that we need to reduce consumption if there's to be enough to go around in a world of increasing population. Put in simpler terms, we have to use less stuff. But how much stuff do we really use? It turns out that we use a lot more than we realize. John Ryan describes it. He wrote a book with Alan Derning called Stuff, which analyzes things we consume every day.
A lot of us start out our day with a cup of coffee, which is a fairly innocent-seeming part of our lives, but it, like other objects we look at in the book, there's a whole array of kind of secret stories, secret impacts behind the scenes to make that cup of coffee. If you take, say, a pound of coffee beans from the store, for every pound of coffee, of ordinary coffee, about half a pound of fertilizers has been used up to fertilize the coffee trees that grew that coffee, and maybe 2 pounds of coffee pulp from the berries that surround the coffee beans were dumped probably into some river where they caused pollution that harmed fish life. And, of course, to get the coffee from where it came from, some farm, maybe Colombia or Brazil, to us, there are all sorts of other consumption that happens along the way, from energy used to dry the beans and to roast them later, energy to transport them, energy to build, say, the tanker ship that might have brought the beans from Colombia up to New Orleans, where they were then trucked in another truck that got maybe 6 miles per gallon to bring them up to wherever we drink it. So even though it seems a very simple object, when you look at the whole life cycle of it, there's all sorts of environmental impacts, all sorts of consumption that's happening that we don't ever see unless we dig deep and do a little research on it like we did for this book.
John Ryan is with Northwest Environment Watch in Seattle. Meanwhile, a joint research project involving the World Resources Institute in Washington, D.C., the Dutch Ministry of the Environment, and researchers from Germany and Japan has been underway to determine just how much we really do consume. I spoke with Alan Hammond, program director at the World Resources Institute, about his study. As you collected these numbers, what surprised you?
Well, I think one thing is the sheer magnitude. We're simply not used to thinking in these terms. We all know that solid waste and disposal of it is a problem in many communities, and that's 3/4 of a ton a person a year. We're talking about more than 100 times that much. as the total natural resource use that really supports our lifestyles and that we just aren't aware of.
Let me understand that. The individual creates 3/4 of a ton of solid waste.
Right.
But to permit the individual to consume enough to do that,
enjoy the lifestyle and the services and the electricity and everything else.
Exactly. There's 100 tons of stuff that gets used up to produce it.
About 85 tons per person per year. So more than 100 times as much as the garbage. We spend in the United States about $200 billion a year cleaning up waste and pollution. But we don't spend very much at all trying to prevent it in the first place. So, for example, if we could use metals more efficiently, then we wouldn't need to mine as many in the first place, or if we recycled more of them.
And we wouldn't have to pick up the junk that gets discarded when it's over.
That's right. So it's partly sort of paying attention to not just what happens after we've used stuff, but to think about it sort of from the very time we take it out of the earth. I mean, you could almost think of it, we take natural resources in and we put waste and pollution out. And clearly, if we want to have less of the latter, it might be useful to have less of the former, right?
Hammond found that if you put all these materials in shopping bags weighing 12 pounds each, every man, woman, and child in the U.S., the Netherlands, and Germany goes through 300 bags of natural resources every week. He describes what's in them.
We've organized it into 6 broad categories. One is food and fiber for our clothes, and, of course, the soil erosion that happens when we grow them. One of the categories is construction, metals and mining, and including taking off all the overburden to get at the ores is a big one. We move around a lot of earth and other materials when we build infrastructure like highways or dredge out the ship channels. And then, of course, the biggest is all the energy we use. Fossil fuels like coal and oil and natural gas.
What Hammond and his collaborators have developed is a new way of measuring things that would take account of natural resources like topsoil that do not have prices attached to them. Dr. Albert Adriaens, senior counselor to the Minister of the Environment of the Dutch government, says this will also lead to an understanding of what's happening in the developing world.
I was surprised then, of course, this in the Dutch case comes is generating in a great many developing countries we are getting our commodities from.
Does this say anything about the sustainability of the Dutch economy and other European economies as we know them today?
I think so. It first of all tells the message then that in the case of the Netherlands we have a rather very obvious situation that we are vulnerable in that sense that we are depending so much on, let us say, the imports from developing countries concerning the natural resources we use for our own economy and to maintain our economy at the present level.
Adriaens says the Dutch government will make reduction of consumption a major goal in its new environmental plan. And the European OECD countries adopted a Factor 10 principle last February. That means they'll set as a long-term goal reduction of resource use to 10% of what it is today. In the end, what they're saying is that the objective is to use less stuff to make stuff. Most of us think of the European Economic Union, or EEU, as an instrument to promote trade and facilitate financial dealings between European countries and other trading partners. In addition, it's having an impact on the European landscape. In Italy, a major effort to create new national parks is underway, spurred by an effort to meet standards set by the EEU. Paul Bray, an attorney specializing in environmental and planning law from Albany, New York, has just returned from Italy, where he was a fellow at the American Academy in Rome.
Well, there's a lot of exciting developments going on in Italy. They've gone from a country in 1991 that had 5 national parks to one that now has 18. They're trying to reach the European standard of having 10% of their landmass be park or protected area, and they're going from a 1% where they were in the 80s to that 10% goal, and there's some place, depending on who's doing the calibrating, in at about the 5% level.
Are these anything more than a line around the map? They've been managing people and nature since the Roman times and before.
Well, in some cases, that's what they are, is a line around the map, and some of these parks are still what they call paper parks. They have not come down to actual management reality. But I experienced a number of them where the management efforts, they're very complex and they're very difficult, but yet they're going forth, and I think in some respects a lot better. They have much more of an urbanistic sense and a much better sense of involving, in some cases, the local population in the park effort, which has allowed them to do things that, for example, we have been unable to do. There's been talk of reintroducing the wolf to the Adirondacks, and despite the fact that the Adirondacks is 6 million acres, more than 2 million of which is public land, there's no consensus on that over here, whereas in their Abruzzo Park, which is 100,000 acres and a number of sort of medieval communities along the basin, they sustain a population of 50 wolves.
How has that been done, and how have local folk felt about that?
Well, initially they were not too happy. In fact, the rumor was that in the 1970s that the park director was flying over the Abruzzo in a helicopter at night dropping wolves. When I asked him if that was a true story, he said yes, but they also said I was dropping vipers. Today, the wolf is very much part of the culture of the communities. There's a wolf museum in one of the medieval towns. It is part of the sort of folklore, almost instantaneous folklore, that was created in this community. And they did it by educating. They educated the young folks. They brought the museum into the community, which created a tourist attraction, which helped businesses within that community. And they did a lot of sort of education and social work in developing acceptability. And the wolf is now, again, sort of part of the proud culture of a small community.
You've done a lot of thinking about parks and urban cultural parks in the United States. Based on what you saw in Italy, what do we have to learn from them, and what do they have to learn from us?
Well, I think we're both sort of have a lot to learn from each other. And again, that's how do you integrate the needs of people and an economy with natural and cultural goals? And it's much easier to say than to do. I think the Italians, obviously, because of their long history, really understand urbanistic issues and urban culture much more than we do. And they sort of understand how to, you know, despite the fact that some of them are much more driven by the values of biodiversity and protecting wildlife and having natural parks, they have a much better grasp of how to work with the local population. So I think we can learn from that.
Bray says conflicts between local and national interests present real challenges to the establishment of national parks. Sardinia is an example.
One of the interesting stories that I heard over there, situations, is a national park proposal for Sardinia, which is driven from Rome, which wants to protect the coastline, except the local people are shepherds and their culture is more oriented towards the mountains, and they don't value the coastal resource as much as the national environmental groups. So if you leave it to the local indigenous population, they have a different set of values, but their concerns are yet still important. And if they're going to reconcile and make a Sardinian national park work, they're going to have to find a way to make sure that the concerns of the shepherds and the local population are recognized and have some degree of protection. At the same token, there's got to be a balance at the local level with meeting the national and the overall European standard. It's not easy, but it's. I think there's less of a standoff and more of an attempt to deal with this than I've noticed in some of the conflicting areas in the United States, such as the Adirondacks or, let's say, the Greater Yellowstone area.
As the world's population becomes increasingly urbanized, the need for park space increases. Efforts now underway in Italy, driven by standards set by the common market, may show how parks can be created that mix historic sites, open space, and wildlife with people. And this is happening in communities that have been settled for thousands of years.
And this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, American Tortoise Rescue. Turtles and tortoises are slow and steady, and against the hare, the tortoise's tenacity proved it was a winner in the end. But in today's world, being slow is not a very winning quality. Because of their pace, turtles and tortoises become easy targets for hunters, illegal pet traders, and cars. American Tortoise Rescue, founded in 1994, serves as a shelter and national clearinghouse for information about the care, feeding, and rehabilitation of endangered and captive-bred tortoises and turtles. Located in Los Angeles, the organization was co-founded by Marshall Thompson and Susan Tellum, a husband and wife team who foster humane treatment of all animals, but in particular...
My husband and I decided that there was a need because there are so many rescues for nice, warm, and fuzzy creatures, but really reptiles are unique in that there aren't as many people who love them as do dogs and cats.
Turtles and tortoises confiscated by authorities, neglected, sick, or found wandering around, make their way to American Tortoise Rescue through word of mouth, newsletter, veterinary clinics, or animal shelters. Many of the turtles or tortoises that make their way to American Tortoise Rescue were bought as pets, Tellum explains.
It's common in large cities, particularly New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, for vendors to sell little tiny turtles, little hatchling turtles, which is illegal. And in the United States, there's a regulation that you cannot sell turtles and tortoises under 4 inches. A lot of people buy them for their kids, which is the second mistake, since they do carry salmonella. And then after they find out that the turtles don't do much, they just sit in a little container, they get bored with them.
So, if a turtle was fortunate to have escaped being flushed down the toilet, American Tortoise Rescue will put it up for adoption. Rehabilitation is not an option, Tellum explains, due to state regulations that forbid the return of turtles or tortoises taken from the wild. This, she says, is because often these reptiles carry diseases which can contaminate wild populations, as has been the case with the desert tortoise in California. Tellum says this tortoise population is now dangerously low because of a respiratory disease. Tortoises and turtles face problems all over the world, and that's why American Tortoise Rescue works as a team with other national and international groups. Whether it be finding volunteers to help with the Sea Turtle Restoration Project in Costa Rica, aiding with an international effort to enforce use of devices that prevent turtles from getting snared in fishing nets, or cracking down on turtles slaughtered for food in the Asian markets, American Tortoise Rescue is in the race to save the lives of turtles and tortoises. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. We want to hear from you. On future shows, we'll be talking green about environmental justice and also about chlorine. So join our discussion by calling our toll-free number, 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Tell us what's on your mind or send us questions you have about the environment. You can visit us anytime on the internet where you can hear The Environment Show. It's at www.enn.com/envshow. As we heard earlier in the show, the technology to generate clean energy from the sun is here. The challenge now is implementing it. But in Kalimantan-Tanga, it's already happened. That's where the Orangutan Research Center is located, deep in the rainforests of Borneo. 20 researchers there once relied on a diesel generator for their power, but the noise scared the animals and it created significant pollution. The fuel also had to be shipped in over long distances. So when it broke down for the last time, volunteers from the Department of Energy came in to set up a solar energy system which today powers the entire research center. The materials were donated by over 100 American companies, and labor came from volunteers at the Department of Energy as well as from some local inhabitants of the forest. John Thornton is with the DOE's National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado. He spoke with Environment Show producer Thomas Lally.
We put a 1 kilowatt photovoltaic system at an orangutan research station in south central Borneo. It's unique in that there's no electricity anywhere. As one of the newspaper reporters from Denver said, the problem is electricity. There is none at this outpost 5 hours up the river past the end of the earth. And that was really true. It was a very interesting project. Research stations operated by Orangutan Foundation International, which is a nonprofit. It supports about 20 researchers who live there year-round who are dependent on either candles or flashlight batteries for light. They used to have a diesel generator, but it broke down and wouldn't work right, and the pollution from the diesel fuel was a big consideration, as well as it made noise, it scared the animals. One of the interesting things about this project was that while we were setting up the PV arrays, the orangutans actually helped us set them up. And we had the unique experience of having these animals sit there and saw boards in half and unscrew screws and handle tools and open toolboxes, hold measuring tapes and help us, things like that. It's not huge intelligence on their part. It's just things that they see humans do and they imitate that. But we have many photographs of us sitting there in the ground putting things together with the help of an orangutan and an Indonesian person and one of us and things like that.
What did the area look like? I mean, what was it?
It's heavy rainforest, poisonous snakes, poisonous sap-losing plants, malaria, 200 inches of rainfall a year, spiders the size of dinner plates. It's a real interesting place. But the system has been in operation now the better part of a year and is working just fine. It has the ability, if they manage their loads correctly, it has the ability to operate for about 20 days and provide them the power they need to charge their batteries and so forth and during the rainy season. In Borneo, sometimes it'll rain for a week without nonstop. So it has the ability to go through long periods of time without getting sunlight to recharge.
The solar panels or photovoltaics had to be enclosed in cages to keep the orangutans, which can weigh up to 400 pounds, away. Thornton says it was hard work, but something he'll never forget. He says the only way to get around in that part of Borneo is by boat, and every night he and his colleagues would travel downriver to reach where they were staying. After a long day of work, Thornton would lie on the deck of the boat and savor the view of the stars. He says the local people were happy with the project, although they may have felt differently if this had been 25 years ago.
And the people that lived up the river where we were ex-dyaks, and about 25 years ago they were active headhunters, which they don't do anymore. They were very pleased to learn about photovoltaics. For some of them, it was the first time they'd ever really experienced the use of electricity, although they have seen it other places, but the first time they ever had a chance of doing it themselves. It set a great example for the population in and around the area of what remote power applications can actually do for them. and we got very enthusiastic support from the local people. Terrific support. The combination of orangutans, Americans, and Indonesians was unbeatable. We had a great time. It was one of the best projects I've ever done, as well as being one of the weirdest.
Solar energy is most cost-effective when used in remote locations like Kalimantan-Tanga. It provides the benefits of electricity without requiring fuel or power lines while creating no waste. It's an even better deal if you get free labor from orangutans. Maybe for a next project, we'll get one to host the Environment Show. By now, you've heard that even orangutans are getting into solar energy. The market is growing, and the need is greater than ever. It's enough to make you want to sing. Victoria Parks is a folk singer from Columbus, Ohio. We hear I'm Going Solar from her 1995 release, Sure Feels Like Home, on Apropos Records.
I'm going solar just as soon as I can. I'm cutting out me losses, I'm cutting out the middleman. I'm going solar just as soon as I can. I'm going solar just as soon as I can. It's just between the sun and me, and that's the way it's gonna be. I'm going solar just as soon as I can. I want to keep me money, don't want to give it to the man. Simplicity is good for me, I'll still have electricity. I'm going solar just as soon as I can. I'm going solar just as soon as I can. I won't be a polluter while using my computer. I'm going solar just as soon as I can. I'm going solar just as soon as I can. I'll be the power company, I'll make them buy it back from me. I'm going solar just as soon as I can. I won't need your strip mine, your hydroelectric dam. I won't need your uranium, illegally mined from Indian land. I'm going solar just as soon as I can. I'd rather keep the mountains, the rivers and the streams. I'd rather keep the rainbows living in our children's dreams. I'm going solar just as soon as I can. There's lots of greedy suits and ties scheming up a scam. They want to steal me money, but I have got another plan. I'm going solar just as soon as I can. I'm going solar just as soon as I can. Cutting out me losses, I'm cutting out the middleman. I'm going solar just as soon as I can. I'm going solar just as soon as I can. It's just between the sun and me, and that's the way it's gonna be. I'm going solar.
Victoria Parks singing I'm Going Solar from her album Sure Feels Like Home on Apropos Records. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 380. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Packard Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.